So we're going to open up to Q&A very soon. I know you're all impatient to ask wonderful, great questions, but I want to start as the moderator. That's the, you know, with like one question for each person, although I could ask multiple questions, but I would like to start with just one and then ask you guys. And in the order that everybody spoke, just because, you know, that way we don't forget what they were saying. But Peter, I want to start with you. Clearly, the European economy has been recovering, no doubt. Everything is you know, on the better path, and you know there might be risks. But some of the things you said, I mean, one of the issues, as you said, this was a balance sheet recession, and when you ease monetary policy, easing rates, even pushing them to negative, but even period, basically pushing them to zero, is supposed to encourage lending. But when you have a balance sheet recession, one, people have to deleverage, so they cannot really borrow more. Two, banks are also trying to clear up high NPLs and stuff that happens during a crisis, so they can, you know, they're struggling to lend more as well. Even with, and I've looked at data, since interest rates were brought down in Europe, lending has not recovered. When they went to negative, they basically stopped declining, which I guess is helpful. But it's, can you really use monetary policy to improve the situation? So was it really low or negative interest rates, or was it whatever it takes that stopped the fear of the euro falling apart, as we've been talking all morning? Or is it a combination, or what do we do going forward with the balance sheet recessions and trying to recover from them?
I'd like to respond a little bit to what has been said before. Also, because you go into a very specific question about the transmission of monetary policy. Right. I can tell you, for example, that when you look at things like the banking lending survey, you look at the, we have a special survey called SAFE for SMEs. You see tremendous differences from what it was 1 or 2 years ago. So the rationing has been reduced very much. And of course, you have to be careful about the figures, because when you look at, there is of course the old loans and the new loans. And you see that very clearly, including in Italy, by the way, the demand for credit for households, for housing, is quite strong now in Italy. So you don't see that in the figures, because you have two processes, the new loans and
the deleveraging,
and the deleveraging story at the same time. So I would just say that the figures you see from the lending surveys show that there are very big differences compared to the situation before. If you look, what we also do is to trace, when we have things like funding for lending, we like the Teltro, you know, these facilities we have, we look at the balance sheet of individual banks, and we can trace, you know, the money. Mm-hmm. And so we have a number of evidence. But you would not expect to see very strong lending figures. But it doesn't mean that with low credit growth figures that there is a problem for the economy. Because indeed, the firms, basically, they have most countries, I don't know Italy now, but most countries have excess savings now on the asset side for NFCs now. I talk about NFCs. They have excess savings, not only in Germany, but in many other countries you have that. And so it is true that they are more conservative on the balance sheet. But we don't see, as we saw before, rationing mechanism. We also saw that in the lending conditions, interest rates, for example, the transmission is perfect now. So that's not the very big issue. I'm not concerned on this. This we addressed, I mean, now the basic questions which has been discussed before is, first, I think you're right. I mean, I was in that debate very much about the economic approach versus the monetary, well, they call it the economic political approach versus the, so you lock in the exchange rates, and then markets will have to be more flexible because you lose that instrument. That was the idea. I, at that time, I was in the private sector. Well, I had mixed feelings about that. And when you had already countries which were very close in terms of integration of product and labor market, if you take the Benelux countries with Germany, France would be a border case, and then you get, Italy, where a little bit the north of Italy and the south of Italy, because the north had no problem at that time, and still now, with the exchange rate, for example. So the situation is, I think, much more complicated than what has been described. But it is true, the basic come from that. So it was a sort of open club. And so politicians tried to design a sort of entry conditions, which, by the way, were not respected, by the way, because the idea was that since you have a single monetary policy, you need to have other adjustments or structural reforms together with fiscal capacity at the same time. So, and that indeed didn't work as was planned at that time. So I take this. I think in the crisis you have to, well, before I go to that, I think we have to be very careful about the nostalgic about the exchange rate as an adjustment mechanism. I think we have to be very careful about that. If you remember also, the exchange rate tends to overshoot usually. You paid very high price in the risk premium. I don't know what were the interest rates in Italy in 93, for example, before they enter in this convergence process, but they were higher than 20% at some point in Italy. I know.
It's not the 20%. History of Italy, also the rest of the world.
No, the history. That's not true. In also, Germany, also they were not at 20%. In Germany, in Belgium, they were not at 20%. So what I say that if you lose your credibility in monetary policy, no, if you lose, it's not my God. If you lose your credibility, you pay a very high price. So I think I can take some of the points you make, but I cannot take the point to say that you have a free ride because you have the exchange rate. It's a perfect instrument of adjustment. I can also see the literature because the independence you have on the exchange rate instruments and the economic performance of the country. Good luck if you want to find, you can find cases in all directions, you know.
Peter.
You don't interrupt me now. you take it after. Because I think you make a caricature also, as many populists are doing. You're making a caricature of the situation. I'm not making a caricature. I just warn that this nostalgia about the exchange rate, I think you should not fool the people. Because the exchange rate is a difficult adjustment mechanism, not such an easy mechanism. And you pay very quickly the price in that. There are a lot of overshooting stories. I can tell a number of. That's why many countries wanted to enter the monetary union. And they wanted to have hybrid system where you have, you remember the snake, they have a sort of fixed but adjustable mechanism. We should not forget all this period also there. So that's one point. Also, when we had the exchange rate crisis in 92 and 93, the single market was very much in danger also at that time. You remember when there were parallel imports, there were problems of automobile imports in some place of Europe because Italy had devalued very much the currency. And so the internal market was very much at risk. Also, the question of exit, I can take all the points. I'm not sure that you're totally right when you say this is the Bundesbank position. I will ask Jens next week. But I don't think...
Ex-Bundesbank.
Well, ex-Bundesbank, maybe. But that's already a qualification compared to what Jan was saying before. So one has to be very careful and very precise in these things. Otmar. Well, it can be Otmar. That maybe is not Bundesbank anymore. As you say, it's ex-Bundesbank, Merum. So that makes a big difference. So we'll see what's the position there. Now, so be careful about the exchange rate as an adjustment mechanism. I just say that. I don't say more than that. And we can discuss. And also be careful about saying that there is an easy road for exit. There are a number of externalities to that. Now, when I say this is a situation which I don't say that there were not mistakes. Huh? So there I can also list a number of mistakes before the construction. I take some of the points you make. I think, and the points I was taking as relatively easy mistakes at that time we should have incorporated is having a single market with a single currency without strong mechanisms dealing with credit cycles, financial cycles. And if I compare Italy with Spain, for example, Spain for me is a relatively easy case compared to Italy because there we have a classical real estate crisis with external funding, cheap funding. It's relatively easy to explain. The length of the credit cycle in real estate created also distortions because a lot of the savings capacity went into non-productive sector, of course, so that reduced the potential growth rate of Spain. These questions are being addressed by the country. I think they came late in the response to the banking crisis, but they have addressed it very forcefully at some point. I mean, I remember the discussions I had with the Guindos at that time, and the adjustment happened. And you see how the economy is improving very much also. That's a relatively classical crisis. There, the mistakes we made about not having the macroprudential tools, not having proper crisis resolution mechanisms. I think these things are being addressed. Much more difficult, and there I tend to agree with some of the points you made. are more the structural things. I don't think that's so much related to the exchange rate. I cannot understand why one doesn't go to the real problems of the Italian economy, which is why productivity stopped to grow already in the early 90s. It's not related, I fully disagree with your suggestion that it's related to the exchange rate regime. I think really the Italian situation is to do with a lot of structural issues that you have. Look at the solvency law. Look about the judicial system. Look at the rule of law in contract. If you want to realize your collateral, how much years it takes, has nothing to do with the exchange rate mechanism, the exchange rate regime in which you are. So the mistake, and there I join Jan to some extent, is to say that there was the illusion that by locking the exchange rate in irrevocably, governments would then indeed do these necessary reforms. And this was obviously too optimistic, and it didn't happen. But the problems with or with the exchange rate, with the exchange rate freedom or not, these problems we see on the labor market in Italy, the rule of law, the solvency regime, and all these things, the product market competition, these things will still exist and that. And if you believe that the exchange rate will give you a free ride to avoid these reforms, that's an illusion. That's fooling people.
Okay, Paolo, I'm going to let you respond to that. But I do want to add a question to relate it to what you were saying earlier. So double barrel, you can respond to Peter and also then go on to my question, which was, from what I understand, you were basically saying we made the mistake in Italy by not bailing out our banks before the whole bail-in regime came in. Everybody else did it. Spain did it. Ireland did it. Greece did it. We should have done it. So you're basically saying we should have. But then Italy with the debt level, public debt level reaching 120% of GDP, would have gone up with that bailout. Wouldn't that be problematic going forward, sustainability? I mean, look, Greece is, three bailouts later, its debt level is at a horrible level. So to keep that in mind, but you can start with responding to Peter. If you want.
I start from the second question, which is easier, So it was a mistake. Now we recognize that it was a mistake because the banking system and the Italian government and the Bank of Italy was against it to intervene in favor of the banks for two main reasons. First of all, we had some budget problems, and so no money to invest, and the people were asking to have directly assistant, not to assist banks. The second are the banks. The problem of private banks in Italy is that they have no sufficient capital. And if you rise, or if you ask to increase the capital, you are changing the equilibrium of the shareholders inside, between the foundation of banks and so on. So the system was paralyzed by the various instances. So it was a mistake. Now it is clear that it was a mistake. It's no problem. The first problem, I am not accusing the central bank for the exchange rates, and I add for the credit rationing, because it's not a task of the bank to do that, because the exchange rate was left to the governments. And there was a mistake, because the central bank should be responsible of exchange rates, because with the monetary policy is in condition to influence exchange rates. And exchange rates in a model like an export-led model are very important. The history of Italy is clear from this point of view. You don't know the economic history of Italy. The adjustment in 1992 and then in 1995 of the exchange rate, it immediately reversed the condition of the balance of payments. And now we have no problem of exchange rate. I insisted on this point. We have a surplus. So we have a problem of exchange rate because for a lot of reasons, included the current political conditions, people don't believe more in Europe and in Italy, and so they are exporting money, and so the exchange rates is under pressure. But we don't need now. We do not consider now that the problem in Italy is a problem of productivity. is a problem of terms of trade. At the beginning, I said that Jan Kregel advanced the model based on the terms of trade, not on monetary parities, on the terms of trade. And the terms of trade of Italy are favorable, which is different from Greece. This is why I say if we have to implement the suggestion of Jan Kregel that 2 days ago Professor Sin insisted again to permit people to leave, to adjust, to go back. So your point is about, yeah, is the problem that you put is the relevance of exchange rates. Or from the point of view of the economic history of Italy, is one of the variables. I said that what happened is that we need to control money, to control the interest rate, the exchange rates, and the possibility of intervening in fiscal policy. Naturally, is based on a general principle, because if you have a political condition inside not able to govern these four variables, it's better to stay in Europe. I am insisting that we need Europe, we need in a common market in Europe, because if you don't have the same money when you have a common market, the system enters in crisis because there is no adjustment of the exchange rates. This is the philosophy. And this is why many people, including myself, and the Jan Kregel said that to have the euro was the end of the story of the political unification. This was the mistake. And the ECB has no responsibility on that. The only responsibility is that you are not stressing that this is the problem. I can understand that you cannot do that. But the problem is that you cannot have a money without a political unification of Europe. So if you give a reply that is possible to do that, saying that the euro is irreversible only because you are forced to keep the euro, any cost you pay for that, this is the wrong approach from the political point of view, because we'll never reach a consistency between the economic development and social development. Then you have the five stars movement in Italy, which is going to power, because this is the problem, because now they vote against and not in favor. We are not in favor of five star movements. We are against the other initiative. The same is in France, if Marine Le Pen will win. They are voting not in favor of Marine Le Pen, but against the political implemented by Hollande and the others that are following the same line. We have to understand that. So there is a problem. And Roosevelt said once that when something do not work, you have to change. So if you are happy that the system is working,
no, different ways. Change.
Thank you. I don't know. This is my position. So,
yeah.
And now there is an important point of view that exchange rate in Italy is very, very efficient. It's the base of the economic policy in Italy since after the World War, and also during the fascist period, because during in 1926, the Mussolini revalued the lira, it created a lot of problems in the economy, because for the first 10 years, the fascists were successful, and also pegged by the United States, also some other countries. But after the decision of 1926 to revalue the lira, the economy, the Italian economy, went really in a disastrous condition. And we entered in the war in economic, severe economic crisis. Was a good shock, a big shock for Italy, because otherwise, if Mussolini behaved like Francisco Franco, perhaps Italy now will be under the old organization of fascism. But now Europe is pushing to go back with the five star to the same condition, because it's a confusion in fascism, the five stars. And so I hope that Europe take care of this political evolution in Italy, induced by economic management of Europe. Thanks.
Jan, if I may ask one of you, and then we'll open up to questions. So the way I understood, so you said the bond vigilantes don't work because you have a single currency, so everybody, you know, all the interest rates went down to the same level pre-crisis, and they did. I remember doing a chart. Greek bonds were at 20%, Italian bonds were at 10%. They all came down to the same level with the German bonds. But that was partly because of the no... everybody expected no bailout to really mean bailout and the euro to stay together. During the crisis, during the sovereign debt crisis in Europe, we saw that those spreads widened. I mean, German bonds stayed low, but the Italian bonds, Greek bonds, Spanish bonds, they all went way up. So investors were pricing in the risk of them defaulting, and Greece did default very late, and after all the debt had been transferred to the public sector. But instead of trying to, you know, get countries out of the euro so they can readjust and come back and whatever, is it possible that we actually really stick to the no bailout clause, and investors now do expect, sort of the way too big to fail in banking no longer exists and you expect the bank to fail so you can lose money as a creditor, then countries will have to adjust their structural problems, because otherwise the bond investors will punish them separately from whatever other euro countries' bonds are doing. Do you see that as a potential solution?
Okay, again, I will do truth in lending now. As I've started out in the beginning, I said this. Most of this was taken from pamphlets that had been written either before or after the introduction of the euro. So this is, as I said, this is not my own evaluation or position. On the other hand, I thought it was very useful. Why? Because we're currently in a situation in which the policies that are being implemented in order to keep countries within the euro are producing political responses which may, in fact, eventually cause countries to leave. So, number one, I thought it was very interesting that if you go back to the beginning, that this is something that was foreseen already before the introduction of the euro. That is, the Bundesbank had this as a possible solution. And it also provides a response to these political pressures. And what are the political pressures? Well, it is eventually taking on this idea of two-speed solution, one which so far has only been, as far as I know, advanced by members of the German government or the Bundesbank, but eventually, I presume, will come under increasing discussion. So the question was, is there some logic behind this? Why are all these people pushing for two-speed? Is it because we want the Greeks to forever be excluded from Europe, or does this still enter into the idea of a project of eventual European unification and integration? And it's from that particular point of view I thought this presenting the discussion in this way was particularly important. Now, in order to respond to the question, as we said, the proposition that I made was that in the period before the introduction of the euro, in fact, okay, the convergence of risk-adjusted yields had been foreseen. Okay, they expected this to happen. Now, this is, number one, for anybody looking from the outside, totally illogical. Okay. If you look at the debt-to-GDP ratios, the divergence of debt-to-GDP ratios across countries, you would never have expected that you would have had that kind of convergence. Secondly, if you had taken into account the fact that monetary unification was only monetary unification and not unification of national capital markets or national supervisory structures, you also would have been extremely surprised that you had this sort of convergence. So not so much my argument that the bond vigilantes could not, it's that the bond vigilantes were so fooled in the beginning, as you say, by the fact that the no bailout or the bailout clause was going to rule. I'm not sure which one is more relevant, okay? Because if you're a banker in these sorts of conditions, now, the no bailout clause says, yes, I've done the right thing, because the countries will, in fact, introduce policies that will make convergence a reality. Or if the no bailout clause is not substituted, then I have no problem because I'm going to get paid off anyway. Okay, so in that sense, it really didn't make much difference whether you had the bailout clause or you had the no bailout clause. The point is that if you look at the logic behind the argument, and this is, I just now realized that I'd skipped over this slide when I did the presentation, which is, again, a crucial part of the argument, is the statement, again, this comes straight from Issing. While the conditions for entry are strict and failure to meet them produces the ultimate sanction, exclusion from the euro. Okay, so he said, after entry, there are few sanctions for failure to maintain entry conditions. Here is an asymmetry that is inappropriate in the design of the system. And he's saying, how do you resolve that? Well, you need incontrovertible pre-entry proof. How you get this, I'm not sure, because Goldman Sachs exists in the world, and Goldman Sachs is always going to be able to produce for you a debt-to-GDP ratio and a deficit which meets the entry conditions. But if you believe that you can find incontrovertible pre-entry proof and hard post-entry sanctions that debt and deficit conditions will be met. And then, bottom line, this requires strong political unification. You need a government that is willing to do this. Now, the other part of the argument is that it's not that devaluation may be more successful. It's the fact that devaluation is the politically easy solution. That is, the devaluation may not work. That is, you may end up losing more in terms of potential GDP than if you had acted initially in order to bring about the adjustment. But that's really not the discussion that's going on here. The fact is that devaluation is the way the government avoids having to take these very hard domestic solutions. So basically, what are you doing? Well, if you have an internal dispute between manufacturing and labor wants a real wage which is of this level, and the manufacturing industry believes real wages have to be this level, and the government cannot resolve it, what do? You give it to the exchange markets, and the exchange markets then eventually impose that solution. So the argument I think they're making is that unless you have the government that is able to do that, to resist the devaluation when you have that possibility, then it really does not, nothing, you know, it does not provide any necessarily any better solution. But the point is, once you're in the system, that is no longer available. So it means your only alternative is basically introducing the kind of austerity which is going to pollute, is going to
austerity.
This
is what I don't understand. Yeah, okay. This discussion. I think there are many reforms which are really independent of your exchange rate.
Yeah, okay. Point.
And the list, unfortunately, is huge in Europe. Is huge.
Yeah, okay. Point taken.
I think this is the basic problem. So with always the exchange rate flexibility, it is true that you can have breathing space, you know, with historical, you have seen that. Yeah. But the problems come back immediately, very quickly. You, because of import prices going up, there are very small open economies, very integrated in the global production chain. Yeah. And so very quickly you lose the benefit. You know, when in Belgium, we devalued many years ago, and we immediately had wage control to avoid this. So governments were extremely unpopular, so you could use these windows sometimes. But you do it once, twice, and then markets start to learn very quickly. Yeah. And then as soon as there is the constraints via capital markets, you know, in a free-floating exchange regime, comes very quickly. And if markets do not trust it, you pay it very high risk premium in the markets. Where you have a point, I agree with you. Once you are in, you know, what are the discipline? So it's sort of mutual trust, you know, sort of system that you put in place, where the sanctions are really quasi non-existent. And that's a real problem here. Yeah. And that creates the trust that we have today in the completion of the banking union, for example. Yeah. Now, on the Italian banking system, just to clarify...
Okay, I want to open up the questions so we have time.
Well, now okay. that I said it, it is true that I remember very well the first wave. It is true. I remember also the discussion. Italy was totally isolated from the global financial system, and it was even given as an example of a, maybe not a very efficient system, but something that would be outside of, you know, financial innovation and all that. And it's really the two, three recessions actually in Italy that really... created the problem in Italy. So it was a more a macro story in Italy, there I agree on that, than the Spanish case, which is a different sort of case. Yeah. And but no, I stopped because...
Okay, yes, I really do want to open up the questions we have. Yes, where do we start? I think I saw that hand right next to you, that gentleman. Yes, I saw his hand first, sorry.
Thank you very much. This has been a terrific panel. I wanted to make some comments about we had a political problem back in the 90s, as you were saying, Jan. We didn't come up with a political solution. I think we're going to come up with a bunch of political solutions if we don't deal with something soon because of all that was commented about the separatist movements in so many countries. I think deflation is much harder socially than reflation, and I'm not talking about hyperinflation. And I think one of the keys to the problem that has developed that wasn't discussed was that the assumption that wage increases should be below productivity. If we do this for many years, you have a period where one country, a major country, is massively more productive at lower cost than the other countries. And they've been doing this for years. And so I guess what I would like you to say, you know, Peter, particularly when you're meeting with the new Bundesbank, can't they begin to raise wages at least in line with productivity, or perhaps even more than productivity since they've been doing it for so many years? You know, I and other people thought Trump was crazy again when he talked about Germany has to revalue their currency. Well, he's wrong. They can't revalue their currency, but they can adjust their wages, and it would be a better solution than many countries leaving the EU.
Okay. During period of deflation, it's easier to reduce salaries instead of increasing productivity. This is the kind of adjustment which is, at least in Italy and somewhere, the same. So the problem is, again, deflation. And the people are not sensible to deflation, are sensible to unemployment, the result of the deflation. And they instead accept a more inflationary period. This is my point of view.
Okay, we'll take a few more questions. I saw his hand also very fast. Thank you.
Jan's wondering what I'm going to say, because Dimitri's not here. We'll talk about Dimitri Papadimitrios, who's very involved with Greece and everything else. You said something, Jan, that sort of been flashed over, and nobody's really discussed it. You talked about the political aspects, not monetary. If you remember here, about a week ago, Hannah Arendt from Heidelberg University had a speaker discussing the euro. And the speaker said one thing that was very interesting, that without a constitution, you've got a real problem. No matter how many geniuses there are in economics, it's a real problem without a constitution to meld all the countries. But what you said about Italy, World War II, and I'm going to go back before the Maastricht, and where I get my information is from friends of Dimitri, and more important, names that you'll recognize, Moens Camry, the former vice chairman of the EU, who just passed away just before Christmas. Why was the EU really put together? Nobody wants to discuss it here. It hasn't been brought up. But among economists of your day, go back to Italy during World War II and prior to 1990s, I'm going out of the middle 80s, the original concept, and you mentioned it, Jan, about political, was really, yes, economics was very important, but it was also among this group, and Mowens was a very big backer of it, and so was other people, to stop World War III. That was the basic understanding of what everybody had and what they were trying to do, all right? And you mentioned it about World War II, the Italian situation, and as you know, many countries that went into Maastricht, like Holland or the Dutch, all of a sudden found that their money had been greatly depreciated by what was set up at the particular time. So I just want to bring that up to you because you mentioned it, Jan, about the political ramifications, which hasn't really been discussed, and you mentioned it with reference to Mussolini during that particular time. And that was really the undercurrent of a lot of things that went on in the economic situation. And that's according to people that Dimitri knows, and that's according to, including Mowens Camry, that you both know of or know who he is, who just passed away with the vice chairman of the EU. Thank you.
Other questions? Yeah, right there, hand. Not working microphone.
It's on. It's on. Okay.
Okay. Torvald Levy, Institute, former Central Bank of Norway. I have a question for Peter Prant regarding the outlook. I was just looking at the IMF WEO for the euro area, and they are sort of showing a tapering off from, I think, 2 to 1.5. And my question is related to this sort of lowering of expectation that you mention that, that we also discussed regarding the U.S. economy yesterday, where, you know, we saw that the potential output has been constantly revised downward, and so we're sort of saying that we are in a pretty good situation and accepting growth outlooks of around 1.5-2%. And my question is really, how did we come to a situation where we suddenly see this as the new normal, and even as the situation where monetary policy should perhaps start to be tightened? And I think you mentioned also the unemployment rate, but as we discussed yesterday for the US, employment has not increased at the same pace as normal. And so there is perhaps much more slack than, you know, we would expect. So my question, I guess, is twofold. I mean, where are we? I mean, because we seem to have someone being pretty rosy and upbeat on the outlook, like you, and then you have, you know, evidently more slack in the economy. And then the question is, what can we do? And monetary policy has been accommodating for long. IMF and others have advocated more fiscal stimulus. And even the European Commission has, in its own paper, advocated a very modest package of fiscal stimulus. But there doesn't seem to be much support for it. So what can be done to get growth back up? Thank you.
Thank you. Peter, you want to answer a couple of these that you've been taking notes on, and then we'll take more questions after that?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, first on politics in general, we have French elections. We will see next week a little bit what it gives, because when you look at opinion polls, this, contrary to Italy, by the way, but the support for the euro is very strong, which led some of the candidates to nuance a little bit their position in very recent communication. You see that. And we should not forget the other part in some of the countries, not in all countries indeed, but in France in particular, or in the UK, you have the migration problem. I mean, I don't think the elections are about a referendum on the euro. There is a lot of discussions about regaining control, migration, and I don't know, something on the economic policy in general. But in the global environment, it's not so easy to do. I mean, that's so I say whatever the exchange rate. See, look at the debate in the US, for example. So regaining control in a global environment, what does that really mean? I mean, so we still believe that the exchange rate is not the main issue that we have. Of course, there may be in the adjustment process a number of problems, but basically it's, I'm sorry to say that, but there are deep structural problems in a number of societies. And I also go into the income distribution part, the impact of migration, for example, there was a question of wages in Germany. basically, you can see the labor market in Germany as a country where the manufacturing sector has increased in the crisis in terms of value added, not in terms of employment, but in terms of value added. So the share of manufacturing has increased in GDP in the crisis. The wage policy in Germany, you could see it, but it's not proven what I will say. But there is a sort of awareness about the consequences of wage claims by the unions on the manufacturing sector. It's a big sector in Germany, and in the consensual sort of model that you have, it is somewhere, it looks like, as the employers and representatives of the employees or the workers have a sort of exchange rate, the implication of wages compared to what the others. So there is a sort of awareness there. And so there is wage moderation in the context that you can see.
Relative.
Yes, which doesn't facilitate the internal adjustment process, which is an issue indeed. Now, the non-traded sector, services, there you could say, well, in that sort of environment, because there is a sort of full employment sort of situation, there you should see wages increases in the non-traded sector compared to the others. But there you get probably, and as I say, this is tentative what I say, you get the impact of migration, for example, and the very cheap, flexible labor market that you have in Germany, which explains also why unemployment rate is so low. These are jobs which are not, looks a little bit more US now, that part of the labor market, than it used to be in Germany. And that's a debate you have in the electoral campaign now in Germany about that. But it could be also that for the protected sector, when we look at inflation in services in Germany, and you look at wages in Germany, there is some good correlation, of course, because wages are very important in the services sector in general. And you see that the wage evolution remains subdued in the services sector as well. There, the public sector has some room. And it's true that there is some elements of incomes policy in dealing with the problem in a sort of cooperative way. And some people, including in the Bundesbank, this time people working at the Bundesbank, like the head of the economics department of the Bundesbank, has defended also that wage policy would be part of the adjustment process also. These are not easy things to deal with. But I wanted to say on the political situation, you have the migration dimension we should not forget, including the impact on wages in services, and I think in Germany in particular. So that's one of the complex issues. And I mentioned the manufacturing. But I think the main question is the incapacity of governments to convince their voters of the necessity of structural reforms. And I mean, look at Italy. Why do you have in Italy so many micro firms in Italy? And you remember that was linked very much to the labor market legislation, which you have triggers, you know, at very low levels. Then you need, you know, unions representative, and the more you have people, you know, that. And it's very easy to see how the landscape, the industrial landscape evolved in function of these simple labor laws about size of firms. And if you believe that the diffusion of technology is very much linked to the size of firms, because the micro firms, the very micro firms, are not very good in the diffusion of technologies, then you can also see the link between labor market policies and the diffusion of ICT, ITC technologies, for example. There are papers on this. I'm not inventing that. There are very good papers on this. So you need in Italy, as in other countries, but especially in Italy, a number of comprehensive reforms, which are not necessarily in the labor market, but are comprehensive. I mentioned insolvency procedures in Italy, the efficiency of getting back collateral when a bank lends, I mean, to deal with the NPLs, that has been a key problem that you have, et cetera, et cetera. I'm just saying that don't sell to the voters that when you get the exchange rate flexibility in an exit, which would be extremely difficult to manage in terms of stability of contract, but don't sell to the voters the idea that it's an easy ride that would avoid to face the hard reality. On the banking system, I would say the same in Italy. It was not linked to financial innovation in the beginning. It was linked both to the economic recession. Then I think you have a point on the lack of management of demand in especially 2010 and 2011, which in Italy created, of course, the problems in the banking system. But you don't tell the other aspect is a huge cost to income ratio already before in the banking system was not the most efficient banking system, and there's a big need of consolidation in Italy. When you say bail-in, bail-out, a story now, I say the BRRD provides for flexibility for financial stability reasons, so there are discussions about that. I don't want to go into that discussion. The only thing I can say that bail-in or bail-out, what I would like to see is a result of either or. You see a very structural adjustment in the banking sector. You see, I mean, really, that things are being addressed. Whatever the money comes from the taxpayer or from the private creditors, you want to see the results. And that has been quite slow compared to what we have seen in Spain, for example, in the experience of Spain, for example. So these are also things I think this is well understood now by, in Italy, of course, that problem. But that has been very slow in the adjustments. For me, the debate is not only, it's also bail-in, bail-out, which is a real debate. But the main debate is whatever the money you put, you know, from creditors or from the taxpayers, you want to see results on the adjustment process. And that has been very slow, I mean, in some pockets of the banking system, because I wouldn't say at all that there is a problem, a systemic problem of the banking sector in Italy. Because as you know, it's pockets in the system. It's not the whole system. Now, other questions? There was, I'm upbeat. A bit on the economy. Well, it's relative. Don't forget, I'm a central bank. I look at the closing of the output gap with a potential output which is slow. So from my point of view, closing the output gap would put pressure on the inflation at some point. So that's our mandate, if you want. Now, if you take a broader, nobody can be satisfied about the slowdown of productivity because all the promises on budget and off budget in terms of pensions have been based on much higher potential growth rates. And so the problem is the sustainability of public finances looking at 10, 20 years from now, which is a problem of the slowdown of productivity. And if you combine that with the income distribution problem in a number of countries, then of course you say that there are downside risks from the political side, from the society, and so these rates are not. But there the central banker cannot do much. What the central bank can do is support demand in recession to avoid, you know, hysteresis, and this is one sort of discussion. But the fundamental problems are still there, and you can manage, of course, the recession to some extent, and how do you convince the population that there is a cooperative game to do with reform, and relying too much on demand and the exchange rate induced, you know, boom that you may get, you know, support, I think is fooling the people. Frankly, I really think it's fooling the people. The people who have to see, you know, the product market reforms, the labor market reforms, the institutional settings, et cetera, what I say. And this is, I think this is well understood by what you call the elites. Jan, it's well understood. It's not so well understood by perhaps the population. I don't know. I'm not a political scientist. But...
Okay, sorry. I know there are still more questions, but we have run out of time, and we have a wonderful speaker following this, so we're not the last act. So thank you very much for all your patience. I know you very much.